Okay, today we continue the narrative that we left off at the book of Judges, concluding the book of Judges, and so now we begin 1 Samuel. And we're looking at a transitional period now from this tribal confederacy of the 12 tribes into a monarchy, into the United Kingdom, the monarchy. And the books of Samuel take us into that transition. We saw at the end of the book of Judges that this was the description of the condition, the situation. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit in his own eyes. So it's pretty much everyone for himself, and it becomes somewhat chaotic. And this then leads us to a major issue in 1 Samuel, and that is the establishment of the monarchy, of the kingship. Okay? So, the main characters in the book of 1 Samuel are obviously Samuel, King Saul, first king of Israel, and young David. Okay? But David, it's just pretty much in the early stages of David's biography that we have a presentation in 1 Samuel. Samuel himself is a very significant personage in the scriptures. He is definitely a transitional figure in a number of ways. First of all, he is considered to be the last judge. Okay, we've just gone through the period of the judges, the Shofetim, and these were not just judicial figures, as you remember, but also military, executive figures, deliverers that God would raise up, and Samuel serves in that role as well. So he's a civil leader. In fact, he is the civil leader of this tribal confederacy. The next civil leader will be a king, Saul. He's also a prophet, and in some ways you could say he's the first prophet, but you can see that I have parentheses or quotation marks around the word first, because there certainly have been others who have functioned as prophets previous to this. The word in the Hebrew for prophet, among others, but the most prominent one is Navi, and that word is used of Abraham, Moses, okay? But this is really where we begin the period of the classical prophets, okay? And the reason for this is because we begin the monarchy. And the prophets, the classical prophets, were frequently raised up by God to address the king and to guide the king, to rebuke the king, to correct the king, and so forth. So with the rise of the monarchy, we have kind of the period now of the classical prophets. And so here, this is early in the section in the Jewish canon of the former prophets, okay, which actually started with Joshua and Judges, but now 1 Samuel. And he's also a priest. He functions as a priest, and in fact, the priest of the tabernacle during this period. So you have this combination of prophet, priest, and kind of like a prototypical king. And this is a typological prefiguring of Jesus Christ himself, the Messiah, the Mashiach, the anointed one, who would combine those offices as well. Okay? Now, Moses, in one sense, combined those offices. He was the leader. He was certainly a prophet. Remember Deuteronomy 18, God will raise up a prophet like me. And he functions as a priest. He's of the line of Levi. And although the priests descend from Moses' brother, Aaron, Moses also has access into the tabernacle obviously, and so has that priestly access and the tent of meeting and so forth. So he's very important for a number of reasons, including those that I've just described. The story of Samuel's origins are interesting. There is a couple, a husband and wife. Actually, he had two wives. One of the wives' names was Hannah. And Hannah was barren. This husband was very, very gracious. He did not despise her or look down upon her for her barrenness. And yet she was very depressed and despondent that she had not had a child. Her husband said, "Aren't I as good as 10 sons to you? Hey, I love you nonetheless." But she's in despair, and so she regularly goes to the tabernacle praying to the Lord, asking him for a son. Okay? Eli is the priest. He's the high priest at this time, and he sees her and hears her, or in a sense doesn't hear her because she's just kind of praying and her lips are moving but no words are coming out. And he thinks that she's drunk, she's inebriated. So he begins rebuking her, but then she shares with him what the situation is here. She's seeking after the gift of a son. And she actually, in a sense, makes a bargain with God. She says, "If you provide me with a son, I will devote him to your service." So God is gracious, and he opens her womb, and she gives birth to this son. He is named Samuel, which in the Hebrew means God hears. Okay, and so God has heard her plea, her petition. And after the child is weaned, he is brought to the tabernacle, to Eli, there at the tabernacle at Shiloh. He is raised there by Eli. Okay? While he's still young, he receives a call from the Lord. Okay, so he's now residing with Eli in these priestly quarters around the tabernacle. And Eli has two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who are really worthless fellows. Okay, they're just in the ministry for what they can get. You could kind of say they use the ministry not to feed the flock, but to fleece the flock. They take of the best portions of the meat sacrifices and even those that were to be offered to the Lord, and they make sure that they get those, so they get nice steak meals out of it. They even engage in sex with women who are coming to the tabernacle to worship, and so they are really, really quite worthless. Eli is aware of this, but he's a very permissive father. It's just kind of naughty, 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 don't do that, you know, just kind of a slap on the hand, but doesn't really enforce the law of the Lord on them. So God has his belly full of these two. One of which should have been the successor to Eli as the high priest. And so actually the occasion for the call of Samuel is to let Samuel know what would happen in the future, specifically related to Eli and his sons. The Lord, in a sense, says, "I'm going to squish those two scoundrels, and they're not going to carry on the role as priests here." And so Eli is very, very interested in finding out what Samuel heard from the Lord that night. And Samuel is reluctant to share it with him. Obviously, it's bad news, but because Eli pesters him and badgers him, eventually Samuel lets the news out. And Eli accepts it, says, "Well, I guess that's the will of the Lord." But the point here now is that it's clear that Samuel is functioning not only as a priest in the context of the tabernacle, but also as a prophet, because he now hears the word of the Lord and speaks it forth. And he speaks forth God's word, including prophecy. prophecy of the future here. So that's kind of the beginning of Samuel. Well, shortly after that, we have warfare with the Philistines, okay? And at this time period, and in 1 Samuel, the major conflict will be with the Philistines. So what we saw already in the book of Judges with Philistines there, Samson being the deliverer, the judge for them, now they continue to be a thorn on the side of the Israelites. Okay, so there's a battle that takes place here in Aphek, and the Israelites lose. And at least they have the theological acumen to recognize God must be displeased with us to allow us to lose. Remember the whole idea that the battle is the Lord. So they fetch the Ark of the Covenant, which had been at Shiloh. Okay, Hophni and Phinehas go with it, those two sons of Eli, and they think this is a sure thing now. We've got the throne of the Lord, the throne of God, to go before us in this battle, so no question we'll win. But what happens is that the Israelites are once again routed at Aphek, and the Ark is captured. And Hophni and Phinehas are killed. The news goes back to Eli. He hears about it. Shock sends him, you know, tumbling back on his chair, and so he eventually dies as well. And so Samuel essentially takes over the priestly leadership. But what we have now is what's called the Ark narrative, what happens to the Ark of the Covenant in the hands of the Philistines, okay, these pagan people. And immediately what they do is they take it to Ashdod, one of the five capital cities of the Philistines, and they place it in the temple of their prime god, Dagon. Dagon. And Dagon is like the, I think, the father, or some would say the brother of Baal. So there's the connection with the Baal there as well. And they take the ark into the shrine, into the temple of Dagon, as kind of the prize for their god. It's, in a sense, a statement here, this is the booty for you, God. And the ark is placed below the statue of Dagon, which is standing on a pedestal. So it's to represent the superiority of their god, Dagon, over Yahweh, the ark. Okay, so they leave, the priests do, and the next morning they come in, and the statue of Dagon has fallen on the floor, face down, prostrate before the Ark of the Covenant. They kind of scratch their heads, what's going on here? Well, maybe there was a little tremor or something, earthquake last night, we didn't feel it, but that caused the statue to fall down, the idol fall down. They put up the statue back up, and then go about their business. The next morning they come in, the same thing. The statue has fallen down, face down, before the Ark of the Covenant, and the head and the arms broke off. Okay. So now they get the message. Okay. This Ark is something that is beyond us here, and beyond our God. Well, the expression here is that the God of the Israelites, Yahweh, whose throne this is, bows to no one. All other gods submit to him. So the folks in Ashdod want to get rid of the ark, so it's passed on to Gath, and there's possibility that it also went to Ashkelon and Gaza, from some later references talking about all five cities being involved. And from Gath to Ekron. And so this becomes kind of a hot potato, the ark being passed on, because wherever the ark goes, there is plague. And the plague is described as tumors of the groin. So it must be God's sense of humor here, giving them tumors of the groin. The Philistines then even decide, well, we have to appease this God who's giving us these tumors. So they actually make golden tumors. Okay, they fashion tumors out of gold and then send that along with the ark, hoping that that will appease the God. Finally, they say, we've got to get rid of this thing. Okay, so they then load it up on the back of an ox cart, and it's pulled by two cows who then take it back into Israelite territory, Beth Shemesh here, okay? And eventually Kiriath-Jearim. But so here you see the Ark of the Covenant being pulled along by the two cattle there. And the people, the Israelites, behold this, and they say, wow, wonderful, okay? So they take it into Beth Shemesh, but they're curious. And you know how curiosity killed the cat? And if you remember the Raiders of the Lost Ark, the curiosity of the French archaeologists and the German commanders, they wanted to see what's inside the ark. That was the case here with the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh. They wanted to know what's inside the ark, and as a result, 70 of them died. Well, now they say this is something that we want to get rid of, and so they pass it on up to Kiriath-Jearim. There's a priest there, a Levite, who takes possession, if you will, of the ark and keeps it in his farmhouse. So here you have the Ark of the Lord being stored in a farmhouse in Kiriath-Jearim. And it will for decades until David fetches it up to Jerusalem. Okay, so this is called then the kind of Ark cycle or Ark series. And it's again demonstrating God's power, God's might, his supremacy, and he is to be revered by enemy and by his people alike. What follows after this then is the question of, should we have a king slash prince? And sometimes the Hebrew word varies between the two. And we read about this in 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Israel demands a king. Okay? And essentially they're saying, we need a king like the people around us. You remember back in Deuteronomy chapter 17 that Moses had said, one day you will have a king. And so it's already foreordained that there would be a king. In fact, you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, chapter 49, when Jacob was blessing his sons. The blessing he gave to Judah was that the scepter would not depart from his hand, from between his legs as he sits on the throne, which is a reference to the monarchy here. So we have this foretold. But now we have the people demanding a king. And the reason why they demand a king is really pretty immature. It's just because everybody else around us has a king. And it seems to work for them, so we need one too. Kind of like a teenager, you know, those of you who have teenagers. Yeah, everyone else is doing it. Why don't we do it as well? So there's nothing wrong with there being a king, but the motive behind it that they express here is what is problematic. Okay? Samuel, and they demand this of Samuel because he's the leader. He's the civil leader. And he says, well, you've kind of rejected me. I kind of take this personally. You've rejected me. And he goes to the Lord and expresses that to the Lord. The Lord says, well, no, Samuel, even more, they've rejected me. Because I'm the true king. You know, I'm the true king of Israel. And they're just demonstrating once again they've rejected me. But let's give them what they want. Okay? Give them what they want, but then tell them what they're going to get. And this is what Samuel goes back to say. You can follow along in chapter 8, verse 19. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to work. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. So you're crying out for a king. The day will come where you'll be crying out for relief from the king. Because of what you're asking. Remember that. Remember that warning. Remember that prophecy here, because we'll return to it later.